I'm Jeff Tamblyn. I'm with New Day Films, and we are a 40-year-old co-op run by filmmakers. The filmmakers make all the decisions to run the business collectively. We were started in 1971 by four feminist filmmakers who didn't feel that the distribution that they were getting with their specialty films was reaching the audience the way they would like it to, and they started New Day as a co-op, and it's been going strong for 40 years, and we're getting bigger and bigger. We have a number of documentary filmmakers who have either been nominated for or won Oscars and Emmys, and represent titles like Granito and Read Me Differently and Straight Laced and Ask Not. And everything we do is a social issue documentary. That's the focus of our distribution.
Hi, I'm Debbie Zimmerman. I'm the executive director of Women Make Movies, and I just want to say welcome to the least sexy panel at South by Southwest. And congratulations for coming.
You're not talking about the panelists.
I'm not talking about the panelists. I'm talking about the subject of the panel. But I have a feeling that at the end you may not feel the same way. In fact, I hope you don't. Women Make Movies is also 40 years old. We were actually started as a production collective at the same time that New Day was started. But after 10 years, we shift our focus to distribution. We're the largest distributor of films by and about women in the world. I'm usually on educational distribution panels with educational distributors that are kind of only doing educational distribution. So it's really interesting to be on this panel with people that are actually much more similar to Women Make Movies, because we call ourselves a full-service distributor because we create very specific marketing plans, very targeted marketing plans around the films that we distribute. We also pick up a very limited number of films so that we can really work with them. We also have a production assistance program where we work with filmmakers, women filmmakers, through production, helping them to raise the money to get their films done, and then sometimes we'll pick those films up for acquisition. We distribute or acquire between 15 and 20 films a year, again, so that we can really focus on those films. And one of our films that we're releasing this year, Scarlet Road, is actually screening right now as we speak in the Vimeo Theater. We also have had, very proud that we've had films that have won Academy Awards or been nominated or won at Sundance 5 out of the last 6 years, and I can't tell you which one, but one of the films that won at the Academy this year will actually be showing up in the Women Make Movies collection, and if you're very smart, you'll be able to figure out which one.
I'll just add quickly that despite being, as Debbie said, an unsexy topic, and there are far other sexier topics out there like digital distribution and cloud computing and all that kind of fun stuff, it's great that you're here, because for documentary filmmakers, I'd wager for a number of reasons, educational distribution is a much more vital market than digital today.
Lucrative,
yes.
Market. And yeah. I know, you know.
It's not just lucrative. It's the longest life that your film will have. I was here at South by Southwest 12 years ago, and I think that there might be a handful of companies in distribution that were actually here 12 years ago. Almost all of the educationally based distributors that I know are still in business and actually still thriving in business. We have films in our collection that we've been distributing for 30 years. Very, very few other distributors can really make that kind of claim. So, yeah, Ryan, yeah, that's exactly my point.
I want to throw one other little fact in there that's kind of interesting. I was at the National Media Market with Elizabeth recently, and
that's a market where librarians come. It's a film festival for librarians, essentially. So yeah. They come in, academic, public libraries. And we set up screening booths, and we get to present our new releases.
Yeah, they're buyers.
They're buyers, and they have budgets, and they're looking for films to add to their collection.
Right, and I was talking to one of the librarians, one of the senior guys from Arizona State, who said that they had recently done a usage survey of all of their library materials and found out that their printed matter had a 40% chance of never having been checked out of the library. So 40% of their printed material had never been checked out of the library at all, whereas only 3% of their digital or film media had never been checked out.
And one thing I'd like to add here is that while we are all pretty much full-service distributors, we are friendly competitors, each one of us is also unique. So, for instance, Debbie specializes in films by and about women. Jeff is a social issue documentaries. Ryan, how would you classify yourself?
I think we're similar. We have a lot of similarities, our companies.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
That's true. And we all have crossover as well. We tend to acquire and release documentaries that deal with cultural change. Very broad. We had a film that was at Sundance, for instance, called Putin's Kiss, that was about a young woman who was a leader in the Russian youth movement and became disillusioned and left. And we released it recently just prior to the Russian elections, for instance, but that's a film that will have a very long shelf life in the educational market. Next thing...
We've got a question.
We've got a question?
Yeah. Did you?
I have a question, but it's...
They want to bring a mic to you.
I have a question that's slightly outside the documentary part. Can I ask it anyway?
Yeah,
you
sure.
Can, but would you wait till they get, we're recording all this, so they'd like to get you on a mic.
Yeah, and I think we're going to structure this panel slightly different than the others that have been here, and more of a conversational piece, where if you have a question, feel free to ask, and we'll just bounce off one another.
Yeah.
That is what I was hoping. Sorry to interrupt, but what... Can I just ask, what is the possibility of the education market for unique narrative films?
Yeah. That's a really good point, because actually we don't just distribute documentaries. In fact, when I've been with the organization, we're a nonprofit organization. New Day, I believe, is nonprofit.
We're
for profit. Oh, it's interesting. Okay. No. We're nonprofit. It doesn't mean that we don't actually make money, because we do make lots of money. But we return lots of money to filmmakers. We're really proud of that. But we are a nonprofit organization. So why was I saying that? Because so that when I came to the organization 30 years ago, we were actually distributing many more narrative works, both fiction, short fiction, as well as animated films. We kind of moved into documentary in a big way about 15 years ago. The key thing when you're talking about educational distribution is that the film, well, it either needs, this is my opinion, and I'd love to hear what you guys think. First of all, you have to think about what college class is going to be interested in showing the film. If you can think of a college class that's going to be interested in showing it for some reason, there's a good chance that it's got a life in the educational market. So, you know, if it's a really interesting film in terms of form, and certainly Cinema Guild has quite a few of these films, as well as Kino Lorber, you know, it might be interesting for cinema studies. So then you're really selling it on the basis of the filmmaker and the style of the film. If not, it needs to be a subject that's going to be of interest to a university class. So, for example, the film that we have here, Scarlet Road, is really kind of a documentary version of The Surrogate. It's about a sex worker who specializes in disabled clients. It will have a great life in disability studies. It will also be interesting for women's studies because of the issues that have to do with the legalization or decriminalization of sex work. Sexuality studies. You know, the more study areas that you can reel off about your film, the better chance it's going to have of having a market. On the other hand, I'll just say that Elizabeth and I were talking before about a film that they have called El Bulli, which is about a very famous restaurant in Spain. And I think it's a fantastic, interesting film, but I said, I'm really surprised you took it on for educational, because I don't really see, you know, I don't see the educational market for it. So
it's been one of our better sellers. We think that there are two different ways that libraries build collections. One of them is clearly for use you can correlate a film to the curriculum, and you know there's film studies, women's studies, anthropology, liberal arts curriculum, and they'll be widely used. But there are other films that they also want in their library because they are the definitive film on that topic, and they want it there so that if they have a research library you know, we find that the documentaries are acquired and they're probably not used all the time in specific classes, but they're wanted for collection development. On the narrative features, we sell our narrative features with public performance rights. And this is also what's very key in understanding what differentiates the educational market from the consumer market, because why don't the libraries just go in to Amazon and buy a copy and put it on the shelf? Some of them do. Don't get us wrong. We all think that Amazon is both our friend and our worst enemy. But when the films are sold with a public performance rights license, it allows for the film to be shown to non-admission paying groups. Usually, in our definition, it says of less than 50. When they charge admission, we go into an exhibition fee, but you can carve out a window between theatrical and a home video release, and you can sell public performance rights, DVDs, to the institutions. And, you know, for every film, there's a different strategy, but some narrative features do have a life in this market as well. It would depend.
You know, one of the things that I actually say, and you can make a really mediocre film about a really important topic and actually do extraordinarily well in the educational market.
What about the opposite?
Or you have to make a really, really good film about a subject that nobody cares about.
Right,
and I'll give you a really good example. We have a film called Sisters-in-Law by Kim Longinato. It played in over 100 film festivals, won major awards, including an Emmy, and you know, nominated all over. It's a fabulous film about two women judges in the Cameroon. Nobody knows where the Cameroon is, and nobody cares. And certainly nobody cares about two women judges. It's been extraordinarily successful for us because it's such a brilliant film. On the other hand, I won't name films from our catalog because all of our films are wonderful, but one might have a film on, for example, right now, a film about Uganda and Joseph Kony and, like, do really, really well, even though this half-hour film is all, you know, 100 million views on the internet. If it looks at it from a different perspective, gives you the history, you know, kind of links into that right now, you're going to do incredibly well.
We actually have a film about Uganda that just joined the co-op. And so that filmmaker, for example, is now he just joined the co-op. He's a pretty much brand new member, and his film covers this the Kony guy, actually, who's been targeted, and some other aspects of that conflict. And so he's trying to piggyback on this great big promotion that's been going on by somebody else in order to sell his film.
I mean, certainly the films that sell well, educational is a whole different market. So the films that could do well in educational are not necessarily the films that could do well in home video.
Yeah.
Sometimes
yeah.
There's overlap. Sometimes the title is big enough and popular enough that librarians and teachers feel that it needs to be part of their curriculum and they want to teach that film. But there are many titles that, you know, are not feature length, that are 50-minute films, 30-minute films, but just have, and there are still quality titles and amazingly directed, but have very potent educational value, and those can do extremely well in the educational market.
I just wanted to say one thing about length, because one thing that we're finding, and I'm curious what you guys think about this, is there, you know, the conventional wisdom was always that, you know, since classes in universities, and by the way, let me just step back for one second, because I think it's really important for people to understand that the when you talk about the educational market, you're not actually talking about just educational institutions. It's also called the non-theatrical market, but the non-theatrical market can include consumer video. Educational distribution includes anybody that's using a film in any kind of setting for educational purposes. So it would include businesses, government agencies, hospitals, healthcare facilities, prisons, forestry services, youth centers, youth groups, women's
churches.
Centers, churches. We sell to all of these places, but 75% of our customers and 75% of most educational distribution is in universities and colleges. So since university colleges are generally either 60 minutes long or 90 minutes long, it's always been said that the shorter the film, the better chance you're going to have of getting it distributed. What we're finding now is that it's not the case at all. We have versions of films that are hour-long and 90-minute long, and people buy the 90-minute version. And I think the reason why is a little bit of an interesting, also kind of maybe evil thing, which is that what we're hearing is that teachers are not showing the full films in classes. They're using them more and more for clips to illustrate points. So if you're a filmmaker that feels really purist about your film, you know, you might want to think about that. But on the other hand, you are getting it out to an audience which really, really is eager to see those films.
I think the length, when you're talking about the college university market, is not as relevant. If it's a longer film, they'll assign it to be checked out from the library, and they can watch it on their laptop or on their DVD. The K-12 market, certainly, they're really much more rigid, you know, 27 minutes or 50 max. Most independent documentaries, though, the K-12 market is really a separate beast. It's funded differently. They're looking for things like curriculum standards and teacher's guides. It's safe to say that I think all of us focus on the college university market because there is more flexibility, and the films are being used as resources for teaching, but they're not being used clips, to support a learning objective in quite the same way that the K-12 market does. So, yes?
I had a question when you were talking about release windows. And I wonder if digital distribution is a problem, something we should, like, should then the film not go on iTunes if I'm trying to sell it to an educational market?
We were just discussing this.
New day. We've got certain requirements now in the contract. So you have to come in with your digital rights intact.
Frequently, filmmakers very much want to see their films on various... they want it on Amazon because everybody can buy it. You want it on iTunes because it's glamorous. You want it on Netflix. The truth of it is that the educational market is probably far more lucrative over both the short window and the long term than putting a film on iTunes. We were all just joking that we have frequently seen films, docs, being offered on iTunes, and we don't ever earn back the encoding costs. And it will cannibalize your educational market.
You really need to take a hard look at your film and really think about who is going to be most interested in seeing this film. There are films that we do not acquire because we do not feel that... We think about the educational market as our back end. You know, most theatrical distributors go out with a theatrical film. Nobody makes money on theatrical distribution. They make their money on consumer DVD sales, sometimes with a broadcaster, and now, of course, with VOD. That's their back end. For us, the educational market is our back end. So we're picking up films. We're working with the filmmaker to get the largest public exposure for the film. There was a panel here called Festibution about using festivals as a distribution strategy. We do that very frequently because the kinds of films that we handle are not the kinds of films that are going to have a very easy time in theaters, if ever get into theaters. So we work on this kind of public exhibition as a way of exposing the film to bloggers and critics and all the kinds of people that we want to write about it and to get the word of mouth. We show them at academic conferences. Again, that's the kind of word of mouth that we're looking at to get those kinds of educational sales.
I think that there
are... It's a very different stream, than the one where you're trying to get the individual eyeballs and the individual eyeball sales.
I think that the back end with the educational market can create and help you to reach a whole entire new audience. Some films do really well in this market, and some films are going to do much better in the home video market, where you just go out shortly after theatrical and you sell thousands of copies and you move on. The educational market, though, is like a drip at your faucet. It's more drip than digital frequently for these types of films, but it goes over for a long time. It's very much a long tail market.
But you have a wonderfully captive audience for educational. I mean, if you think about all the books that you were made to read, all the classics in college, and all the movies you were made to watch as part of cinema studies, those are integral to kind of your, I think, most filmmakers' development. And these are films that are reaching that audience. This is a film that a professor is instructing a group of students to watch and discussing afterwards. It's a really wonderful exchange. And just to add to your question about what cannibalizes educational, the main thing that we're finding is Amazon really kills the educational market. And Amazon has made it very easy to put your films on their site through Amazon, you know, on demand, and they make DVD-Rs and they send it on, and it's all fantastic, except that the money you make there, because just putting a film on Amazon won't earn you any real revenue. So you're not going to make any money off of that. The company that will make money is Amazon, because if you have, you know, 10,000 filmmakers put their film online on their site and you make, you know, $10, $20 on each title, Amazon will take up 55% of that share, whereas you're going to be stuck with very, very little, and educators will not then buy that film from companies like us at the higher price point of like $300 or $400.
So you're charging $300 to $400 for your public performance, right?
Well, it varies per title, but basically it's anywhere from $300 to $400 for universities and their libraries, and then a special discounted price of usually $89 or $99.95 for K-12s and public libraries and nonprofits.
You have to sell a lot of DVDs at home video to start to make
that. Yeah, and I like to tell a quick story, because as a filmmaker, I started to distribute my film, which is called Kansas versus Darwin. You can kind of figure out what that one's about. And I was told by a number of science teachers when I first got the film finished, well, you should just sell this for $20 because you'll sell zillions of copies at $20. And I went to science teacher camps with my film priced at $20 and sold maybe four copies at a science teacher camp that was attended by 350 science teachers. And then I joined New Day, and my film now sells greatly for $250 at the college level and $99 at the high school level, and it's selling a lot more than it ever sold before. There's a perception in the academic world that even though people want to pay less, and librarians and professors will often talk about prices that, you know, they should be lower, and there's a squeeze on right now, as we all know. In the academic world, there's a lot less budget out there. So people need, you know, discounts. They need some consideration from time to time as far as being able to acquire a film. But people will also pay more than they say they will pay. And there's a perception that a film isn't worth as much on the academic market if it's priced lower. Just the way it is.
I had a clarification question. I think you maybe just did it, but when you say don't put it on Amazon, it'll, you know, eat up. Are you talking about just VOD, just digitally, or are you talking about also DVDs as well?
I'm talking about both, but specifically the physical DVD side. Both will eat into it, but having it available on physical DVDs will completely cannibalize educational.
You know, I got a theory about that, though. It's interesting. We have our own streaming service at New Day. We started our own infrastructure that we work out of for streaming. But I wonder, and I'd be interested if anybody's got an opinion about this, because I think if you did have like a, you know, nowadays they'll do pre-theatrical VOD that often sells extremely well, and I wonder if you started your distribution cycle with something like that, and it was limited, it wasn't unlimited, kick off some educational distribution.
We've done some experimenting with windows at Kino Lorber EDU on a limited basis to see what the result is, and we have one film called Crazy Wisdom, and it's about Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who brought Tibetan Buddhism to the United States. It's doing really well in the educational market, but there's also a tremendous fan base in the United States, because anybody who has any interest in Tibetan Buddhism, or not, you know, or one of the most influential religious leaders that came to America, they also want to see this film. And so from Alive Mind Cinema, which is a label that we have, we've been offering downloads direct to the fan base. And we have not, we've not seen any cannibalization. And my theory is because when they download the file to their computer, it's not being circulated. It's not, you know, they're not allowed to, we're not selling it to schools, so we know it's going to a consumer. We know it's one download. We know that it's limited to whatever they download it to or put it in their iTunes store and watch it later. So as the market and the technology changes, it can very well be that you could have a full, you know, you could do your theatrical, you'd have a long-term educational window, and you could offer it digitally.
Oh, I'm gonna disagree. I think we're at a moment right now where you can do this. I think it's really true. We have films that we sell on iTunes, which, as Elizabeth said, make no money. And let me just say a couple of things about iTunes, because it's really important for filmmakers to understand this. iTunes works only with aggregators. You as an individual cannot go to iTunes. We can't even go to iTunes. We're trying to make a deal that we can. But right, and I heard that Cinema Guild actually was able to do that.
We are direct to iTunes,
which is great.
Yeah.
You have to work with a lab that Apple approves of. It's very expensive to encode at those labs. Long story short, the aggregator, Apple takes their cut, the aggregator takes their cut, your distributor takes their cut, and then you get a cut. So that's why it's so hard to make. And iTunes does not have stores that lend itself to the kinds of films that we're talking about. You know, they may have label. I don't know if Cinema Guild has a label. Do you guys have a label on iTunes?
We don't have a label on iTunes, but to that point, iTunes is really effective if they can feature your title in a very prominent place on the homepage.
Right.
If it's not there, they have a ridiculously bad recommendation engine, unlike Netflix, which has a really good one. Unfortunately, they have crappy titles these days. But, you know, so the thing is with iTunes, if you don't have your film on the homepage, it's practically non-existent.
Right.
That's the issue there.
Okay. So right now, just to finish what I was going to say, so right now I think we have a moment where there isn't that crossover, but, you know, you download onto your iPad, you're a teacher, you bring the iPad into school, you set it down, you go click, and there's your film. And as convergence, you know, continues to take over, not only is that going to be an issue, but the other issue, which is very important to understand, is how you deal with your broadcaster and how you deal with broadcast rights. Because more and more, I don't know how many of you are also selling to broadcasters, but more and more broadcasters are demanding VOD rights, very extensive VOD rights, for the length of the broadcast contract. And those rights basically mean that in some cases, it could be that your film is on perpetual video on demand through a television. So how are we going to sell copies when any university, of course, they need to do it legally, and they can't really do it legally
Correct.
In some cases.
But no one's ever been put in jail for violating the copyright law that says
exactly.
You have to pay $250 for public performance rights on a DVD.
Right.
They do in Canada.
So these are some of the challenges facing people that are working in educational distribution. To me, the answer, the amazing, magic, fabulous, fantastic answer that filmmakers have yet to embrace, even though I keep on saying it, and I wish that, like, the way to get your cake and eat it, too, is to do versions of your film. Make me an educational version that's just for educational. It's not the version that you put out theatrically, not the version that you may even sell to broadcast, though it's okay if it's the same version that you sell to broadcast. Make me a DVD that has kind of modules on it so that it has your outtakes that kind of expand upon certain issues, same way that filmmakers have gotten used to making bonus material, to having bonus material on their consumer DVD. Make me an educational version. You can then do whatever you want to do with the version that you're doing, and we'll sell it for you educationally.
And found that to be effective? Sorry, I was just going to say, because, you know, we found that, you know, that does sometimes, you know, lessen the bleeding from one market to the other. But for the most part, regardless of the various versions out there, if a teacher sees a film on Amazon, even if it's a different version than what we have on our site, they're going to buy that Amazon copy. And if there's a version streaming on Netflix, I agree completely that right now there's very little back and forth on that. And when the schools get more tech savvy, that'll completely change. But right now, if there's the same film on Netflix, they're going to stream it into their classroom, because I don't think a lot of them are educated enough to know that this is not the version that we are selling or that someone else is selling.
Even if it has a different name?
oh, a different name is a different story. Yeah. Then that's a whole separate issue.
Yeah. Right.
We actually, because we do day and date educational releases with our theatrical, because that's when there's the most buzz and we can send out the New York Times review. We just literally, we call them white labels, and we do plain vanilla DVDs, no bells, no whistles. They're not even really authored and mastered. And we sell these through until the consumer window. And, you know, most of the libraries, they're, in our the feedback we've received is they're not that interested in the takeouts and the extras. So I'm, you know, and so we do these, you know, they're literally got a little white label, has our URL, the title, goes in a clamshell, very simple artwork, public performance rights, license language is written on the back of the cover, and that's what we ship. Consumer, fully authored, 6 months down the road, a year, 2 years, depends how soon my home video vice president starts, you know, throwing a fit because he wants to get it out there to make his numbers.
And what kind of, I'm curious, I'm going to ask a question.
We got more questions.
I know, I just want to ask a question. What kind of numbers, just like a film that does, you could do it by percentages if you don't want to give dollars, but what percentage of sales for like, you know, a title like El Bulli, what do you think the percentage of sales will be from universities versus consumer?
One to four.
So with educational being four?
No.
One.
One.
So
I think in the, this is a film where there's a consumer market that you can reach, people who never made it to the Temple of Gastronomy, El Bulli. It's now closed in Spain. Only film done. That's why it's going to do well on home video.
Okay. So it'll sell three times as many copies on home video. Or well, are you talking dollar amount, or are you talking about units?
I'm talking about units for that particular film.
For that particular film.
There are other films we have where I can tell you that we will be one-to-one. Real Engine, it's the history of the Native American in Hollywood films. On a dollar basis, that'll be one-to-one.
I think we have more questions.
Yes.
That film's available. I mean, I've seen it on Netflix.
Yes. So, yes, we've released it into the home video. But we kept it out for 2 years.
Okay.
And it went into Netflix. We do our Netflix streaming is day and date with the DVD street dates. But
so you're saying you kept it educational for 2 years.
2 years.
Once you sold as many licenses as possible, you
that's,
let it out to the consumer.
So that's
you,
yes.
And technically, you would come up with a strategic plan for release.
Yes.
Into a consumer market. Where
yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
How about somebody over there?
I think I've kind of gathered little bits and pieces of an answer to this, but I think everybody who makes a documentary, in a sense, is trying to educate somebody or everybody about something that they're pointing a lens at. So it seems a little counterintuitive that there's a kind of exclusivity with universities when you're trying to get it out to everybody. So my question is, why is it so exclusive in that sense? And I've gathered little bits of it, but
exclusive in the sense where only one company can sell the film to universities?
Whereas you can't try and distribute it on Netflix, iTunes, cool, without losing this avenue to universities.
Oh,
if I'm correct.
Because they're, you know, not all, as has been mentioned already, not all universities and teachers will abide by the copyright law, and there are exceptions within that copyright law that allow for certain kind of face-to-face instruction. So the only way to really maintain a firm hold on that higher price point for universities is to really control where that film is available, which is why most of us, probably all of us, will only pick up a title for at least for educational distribution on an exclusive basis. Because if we have the film and we're selling it, we know that educators will come to our site. But if it's available on Amazon or from another company or from someone else at half that or less that, it not only causes confusion in the market, it means that school will go to the cheapest price point available.
Yeah.
Or free, you know, if it's on Hulu or something like that.
I have a quick question. I'm unfamiliar with the educational business model in terms of selling to this market. Are you guys, and I'm catching little bits of it, but how does the film actually make money? Are you purchasing outright from the filmmaker, or are each of the licenses then percentage based in terms of going back to the filmmaker? Are there yearly relicense fees? How does it work? Do you mind just explaining it?
Basically, it's on a contract basis. It's very much like book publishing. We sign a contract with the filmmaker. We pay a percentage of all sales to the filmmaker based on the market that we're selling to and based on the price point. It's pretty simple, and it's fairly standard. Educational agreements are generally the reverse of television agreements. Television agreements generally are 75 or 70% goes back to the filmmaker, and the distributor keeps this, or the sales agent keeps the smaller percentage. In educational distribution, it works the other way around. We keep 70%, we pay you 30%. We also have a deal where we do a 60-40 contract, but that's generally the highest percentage that you're going to find for educational distribution. It's a very cost-intensive process. We actually send out DVDs to universities for free to have them preview it. We have to do a tremendous amount of marketing to get it out there. We all produce catalogs. We do, you know, somebody said on a panel that the cost of marketing has gone way down with social media, and I disagree. That might be true if you're not doing million-dollar ad buys anymore, but the cost of marketing is people time. It's even social media. It's somebody out there continuously marketing your film.
Okay,
well, of course, New Day is a co-op.
I was just going to say, so our story is different than the other distributors because we're cooperative. So if you're a New Day member, you're doing the work of marketing your film, and you'll be helped and coached by other New Day members in how to get this done effectively. But you'll keep 60 to 80% of your revenues as a co-op member. So it's a little bit different model. It's not for everybody, obviously, because some people don't want to do that kind of work. But if that's something that, you know, sounds good to you, then you might be, you know, a potential New Day
librarians also know the various distributors that they like to do business with. And most of us have really well-established relationships with the librarians in this field. And while it's not impossible as an individual filmmaker to go out, you don't have the in-house list. You don't go to the various, librarian meetings, et cetera. So, questions? Minnie.
The guy in the back has been his head up the whole time. You don't have the mic, but just go for it.
Todd, I'm from Pennsylvania. I made my first documentary film. It's about trust in America, and I'm spending my own money doing it. That's more of a business thing.
Ouch.
Thank you. I should have asked you this question before I started. My issue, I want to get as many people to see this film as possible. That's really my goal. I think it's a message I just want to get out of being, get into the world, and I want to get people to look at it and see what they think. So it's not about money, although it would be really helpful to give some money back.
Yeah, can you hear me? So, and I'm just, if I was going to start this project, a year and a half ago, and I was coming to you, and I said, look, I want as many people to watch this film as possible. I'd like to get some money for it if I could. You know, what are my chances if I came to you and said, help me distribute it? It could be education, it could be theatrical. I'm not really that concerned. I'm more interested in how I might get it out. But how much money am I likely, just in general, to get back? Is it $5? Is it $5? I mean, what are the ranges and what's the average? Could you tell me that? I know it's a general question, but just
about it. Just want your film to get seen, if that's your main mission, then yes. I mean, that's good to know. That's an excellent thing for a filmmaker to know, is that that is your objective. If you know that going into the distribution cycle, or even before you start your film, that's power in your hands, because you know what you want. And so many filmmakers get to, a festival even, and they're like, oh, I don't know. I don't know what I want. What can I get? Well, you should know what you want, and you do. So that's excellent. You know, if you just want everybody to see your film, put the damn thing up on YouTube and send out a zillion emails to everybody you know and tell everybody you know to pass this along and make it really exciting and make the damn thing go viral.
Right.
And everybody will look at it and see it. Right. And if you want to make some money back on it, then you have to figure out how to sell some of it. And, if you're doing that distribution by yourself, you're probably going to want to hit a lot of events or something where people can, you know, buy your DVD. But you're eventually you're going to have to get it up in front of people.
And I just want to speak to the question that came over here earlier. If we answer your question,
no, you do. Unless you, I don't know if there's another perspective. Is there anything else you would share about the same thought?
I mean, what are you trying to?
No, I mean, yeah, I was just saying, is another way, is there any other thoughts about how you might go about this? But that's good.
I think Jeff is right. If the main goal is to get the film seen by as many people as possible, Hulu and YouTube are the best ways to do that. But you won't monetize anything there. You need to make some kind of, and, you know, the other question is, if you put a film, at least right now, there's a perception, price is to a degree directly related in people's minds, to the value of a film. Yeah. So if a film is free online, you're going to have people watching 5 minutes and then tuning out and going doing something else. If there's a value attached to it, whether it's a home video value or an educational value, it's a different viewing experience. And that's really where you'll get more eyeballs and more influence.
But I also want to ask, you know, why do you want as many people as possible to see it? Because there's a whole issue of impact. You know, you can't, it's not just that they'll see 5 minutes. You know, one of the reasons why I believe so deeply in educational distribution, even though it does seem exclusive, is because I think it's fantastic to get films that have social meaning to people between the ages of 18 and 22, when they're at a time in their lives where they're really open to a lot of different ideas. We had a film that we released called The Greatest Silence, Rape in the Congo. The film came out the same month that the New York Times had their first story about how many women were being raped in the Congo. It was tremendously successful. It was at Sundance, won an award at Sundance. But the most important thing that happened with that film was because of a screening of 40 people at a foundation in New York where the wife of the UN ambassador came to the screening, brought the DVD home, showed it to her husband, who introduced a resolution at the Security Council to give the peacekeepers more power to protect the women in the Congo. You know, that to me is impact. So the question to me is not how many eyeballs, it's which eyeballs, and what happens after they watch the film.
But I love the fact that, you know, that you asked, because I sat in on two digital panels this week, and that question of how much money can I actually make was never asked. And it's, you know, the key question why everyone is all here to a degree. You know, educational is a niche market. To a degree, you can't make as much from the educational market in terms of heights as you can from home video. But on average, most educational filmmakers will earn more money from an educational release than home video, based on the stuff that's already been said and percentages and all that information.
You have to bear in mind that there's a glut of product. You know, I mean, be aware that you're operating in an area now where. This is the greatly democratized art form.
And that's what distributors bring when you work with one as well, is we're curating, we're selecting. And so people know that when they buy a film from Ryan or from Debbie or myself or from Jeff, these are films that have been vetted as well. So they're not just, you know, if you go the YouTube route, as Jeff was saying, it's very democratic. So...
Sure, I'm happy to tell you.
Yeah.
Our very, very most successful film ever is a film called Complaints of a Dutiful Daughter. It's a film about Alzheimer's. It's been in distribution for more than 10 years. Actually, after about 5 years, it had made over $500,000 in educational sales alone. That is our absolutely most successful title, and everything right that needed to happen with the film happened with the film. On the average, I would say a good film makes between... Well, I would say between $25,000 and $75,000 in educational distribution. Really good, $125,000, $150,000.
That's gross.
That's gross. That's gross. Yeah. But when you think about home video, it's a hell of a lot more than you're going to see. I mean, everybody wants their films on Netflix. How much, in its heyday, Netflix was paying $60,000 for a film. It hasn't paid $60,000 for a documentary in 10 years. And it's not going to be anytime soon because the model is actually not working anymore. There is absolutely no place besides iTunes where anybody is seeing any kind of money, and the money from iTunes is really low.
Yeah.
I just heard that Google today at another panel that somebody said that if you get a million, if you can push a million eyeballs to Google, you'll get $500,000.
Let's see if we have any more questions.
Yes, my name is Brandon Anderson. I live in Los Angeles now, but when I used to live in Vegas, I remember as a kid, the education film that they showed in every school in Las Vegas was the same sex ed film that they had, like, in the early 80s. They're showing that same film now.
What was the title?
You know what? I just remember sex ed. I can't remember the exact details, but I do remember that it wasn't too interesting, and it looked like it was made in the 70s, and my little cousin just saw it last week. So the fact that they're still showing that in every school in the entire city...
Shows you how broke they are.
My question is, for the life of that film, when you're talking about, I saw it on a projector, now my little cousin is seeing it on a DVD... My question is would that be a successful educational documentary to distributors?
If they're still selling copies.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if they're using the same one that they bought back in the 80s, it's a one-time sale.
Right.
But if they, you know, had to replace it or renew the license or whatever, then it could be, yes.
But wait a minute. If they bought it in the 80s, I mean, I've been doing this since the flood, you know, since 35 millimeter and 16 millimeter. In the 80s, they would have bought it probably on 3/4 inch
right.
or on
right.
VHS. Yeah. Then they converted it to DVD. Now we're selling digital licenses. So this is like, there are films that we have that we've sold 4 different formats.
Yeah.
Of the film. So,
we
yes,
like
it would be very successful.
Yeah.
The other part of that is that no other school has been able to use any other sex ed video. And I don't know if that was part of the deal or if they linked up with the school district or anything like that, but why are they still showing this same sex ed video from the 70s and modified it to a new DVD?
It's what they have, and they're very limited in budget. And some school, I mean... You want to, you know, school budgets are lower now, and especially, did you say Los Angeles?
No, Las Vegas.
Las Vegas. Well, yeah.
No, but it's actually...
Sex ed is a tricky topic, yeah. And to get your film, if you do,
exactly.
I remember I used to work for another distributor, and I'd get these sex ed films in from England or Italy. I'm like, well, we don't teach our kids, you know, those things in that way. So you know, that's one area where a sex ed film that's been approved, gotten past the board, and the parents are okay with it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, that's a really mean accomplishment.
Yeah, I think, you know, we all sell to high schools. High schools are very important for us. But I think for the majority of us, the majority of sales are to universities and colleges, and they're the ones who are buying films that are, you know, premiering at Sundance and Hot Docs and South By and all the major film festivals from all the major filmmakers.
Hi, I'm going to ask a question on behalf of my wife, who's not here, who's working on her second feature, female subject, a councilwoman in Jerusalem who's fighting gender segregation there. How would she, this is her second feature, so how would she submit to you guys, potentially, if she decides that the education market is the way she wants to go, what's the best route for her to reach out to you and submit her film to you?
It's the other beauty of educational distribution. You know, theatrical distributors won't give you the time of day. You can't really send your films to them because they really just don't take submissions. You really have to get your film into a film festival. And if you want theatrical distribution, you really need to be in Sundance, Berlin, Toronto, or the Cannes Film Festival. Educational distributors, on the other hand, are really happy to look at your films. And you can send us an email.
And we actually
describe the film and send us a copy.
And, you know, for me, my interest is spiked because we specialize in Jewish film festivals. So, you know, it's...
So, you know, some of our best-selling educational titles have been cold submissions.
Yeah.
Is that my time? I was hoping to throw an example... which is in relative to a comment that you made, Debbie, to help, I guess, clarify what my options are. 2 years ago, I made a documentary about public spaces. I only went for 24 minutes, but screened a lot of festivals, but also a lot of universities for both, I guess, council planning and architects who wanted to screen it. Now, I see the potential in developing that into a feature, but could go either way. I mean, it's quite an entertaining film, but it's also educational. Now, are you telling me that I could prioritize the entertaining version of it for theatrical, but then look at recutting an educational one that could potentially be sold, give it another title, and eat cake all around.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you do it right, yes. Yeah. It's not, you have to be careful. I think that what Ryan said about the Amazon cannibalizing is absolutely true. We're doing it right now with a film called Cover Girl Culture. There's three different versions of it, and it's working. But I think that, you know, what you just said in terms of options is decide which one you want to prioritize, and that's exactly the other thing that Elizabeth is doing, is she's saying, okay, this film is going to have 1-to-1, this film is going to have 1-to-4, I'm going to have it in educational distribution for this long, and then I'm going to put it into home video. You can also window it. You know, everybody, we've mentioned windows. I assume everybody knows windows are just windows of opportunity. It's a certain amount of time that you have to exploit that market. So you can do it sequentially, or you can try to do them at the same time, and risk cannibalization.
And just to go back to your question, when you asked about El Bulli, I actually was doing the math here while you were chatting. And if we do 1-to-4, right, so one PPR to 4 DVDs, I'm in home video, I've still made, the revenue is switched, it's actually a ratio of 2-to-3. So even though it's fewer units, it's more money.
It's more money in the educational market.
Yeah.
Which has to do, by the way, to you back in the, sir in the back, you know, the idea of impact. Is it how many DVDs you sell or what happens to those DVDs? Every time you sell a DVD to an educational institution, you can assume that 1,000 students are going to see it over the life of the DVD. When you sell a home video, that's one person that may share it with 2 or 3 of their families or family or friends.
And so, when most people go to Netflix, they're looking for entertainment, not to be educated. And I think you have to keep that if your mandate, your reason that you've made your film is to educate people. You know, when we talk about selling to the educational market, it's not just to the librarians and they put it on their shelf. They also screen these things. The public libraries screen them. You know, we get off, I'm sure all of us, we offer community screenings. We have special deals for that. So this is actually a marketing strategy that has to do about targeting and reaching out to communities.
Who's next?
I have a mic over here. Okay. Do you prefer to come to films pre-festival circuit or post-festival circuit? You've talked about helping them through the festival circuit. Do you want to pick them up before they've screened anywhere, or does it vary?
I think it varies. For the educational market, you know, most of the time we hear about films, if it's not filmmakers referring titles to us, it's through festivals. It's through, but you know, it's not just through Sundance and South by. It's regional festivals. We don't attend all of them, obviously, but we cover all of them religiously, you know, through their catalogs and websites, and we follow up with filmmakers. So most of the time, they come through us once they premiere at a festival. But you're also free to send in cold submission before any festival premiere whatsoever.
Having the festival wreath on your package is always a good marketing thing, but you know, I think it's just as important for the filmmakers that I communicate with in New Day, you know, is to build community, because we're all basically activists. We're social activists who make films, as well as filmmakers who make films about social issues. And I think often the sales are generated through attendance at conferences and issue-based forums. So those can be just as important as a festival early on. And there's a lot of films that do extremely well, as has been mentioned, without ever having touched a festival.
On the other hand, we actively distribute ourselves to festivals, and it's a it's a revenue stream for us. And we have relationships with everybody from, I think we did the the Hamptons, Tribeca, on down to the local, you know, Tallahassee, Tennessee. And we are very good because nobody gets to show our films without paying for them first. And so we advocate on behalf of the filmmaker to make sure that these aren't just being screened for free so that the festival is getting an audience, but there's no, you know, what's in it for the filmmaker. So that's actually part of our release strategy.
But, you know, I want to clarify something about that, because I think that distributors can do that and it can be a really good revenue stream. If you're a filmmaker, be really careful though, because if you're a filmmaker without a distributor, you're looking for the festival to help you to promote the film, to help you find a distributor. If they're doing their job as an industry type event, then do not push them for a rental fee, because that's not in your own best interest. We do work with filmmakers. We like to get involved with filmmakers at the very beginning. We'll look at rough cuts, in fact, so that we can help them to carve out a festival strategy that's appropriate for their films. But I also want to say that there are films, what Jeff was saying is so true. There, you know, one of our most successful films, or a very successful film, is a film that I'm sure nobody here has heard of. It's a film, well, actually, maybe one person has. It's called Standing on My Sister's Shoulders. It's a film about women in the civil rights movement in the South. It was not in one film festival. It was not on public broadcasting. It was not on any cable channel. Mm-hmm. It was really needed. It was a film about women in the civil rights movement. So festivals were very, very unimportant. So use festivals as a way to get the attention of a distributor if you don't, you know, but you don't necessarily need them.
My name's Jeff Morrison. I'm from Toronto, and I produced a documentary project called the National Parks Project about the national parks in Canada. And it's just two quick questions, actually. I was wondering if you guys in-house developed curriculum to go with the films, or if that's something
what?
That curriculum, or if that's something that the institutions take on. And also, I think Jeff kind of answered this, but if you will take on films that don't retain all of their digital rights, but take them on solely for the purpose of distributing them to the educational market.
Curriculums? The first part, I don't know what your experience has been, but ours is that curriculums are nice to have, and they're, but they don't always convince a university to buy the film.
Right.
So if a teacher wants to teach that subject, they're going to buy the film. If there's a curriculum, great, it's a plus. But you know, as many times as we've heard from teachers that they love a particular study guide that was put together by the filmmakers, as we've heard teachers saying, I just don't have time to read that. I don't have time to go through that. I want my class to watch the film, and then we'll discuss afterwards.
You know, it depends on the film. There's a filmmaker at New Day who makes films about bullying and alternative families, and they're by far the most popular set of films in the New Day catalog. And she's legendary, and she's won an Oscar, and she's, you know, a great inspiration to us all. And one of the things that she does is, you know, create a tremendous academic community and a lot of study guides, and she's very active with teachers and stuff like that. But that's a mandated curriculum. Those are things that the states, many of the states have said, you know, you have to teach these things because we want to cut down on the bullying and the teasing and stuff like that. So that's you know, a big source of revenue is that kind of standardization. If you've got something about the Canadian national parks, obviously your market is going to be Canada primarily. And if you know, that's a, if you know that all fourth graders will, as you know, in my state, we learned about Kansas history in the fourth grade. Maybe in the fifth grade in Canadian schools, they learn about the national parks or something. You could work it into the curriculum, and then it would really be valuable to spend the time and the money to make that available.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. We hope you learned something.
Here
and that you were entertained as well.
Thank you.